Hi, I'm Isaac Dover. Welcome to Off Message. We have a really cool episode this week. It brings together a lot of different pieces, and we're going to start off with a conversation between Margaret Atwood and Elizabeth Moss about The Handmaid's Tale. Atwood wrote the book. Elizabeth Moss is starring in the new television series about it. And they talked about what it is to have that book going on and that television series going on in their heads as they look at a political situation in reality that they are opposed to, and that in some ways they think connects to what is in the obviously fictional situation of The Handmaid's Tale. If you haven't read the book, you should read the book because it's a really good book and classic book. I have seen the first couple of episodes of the series, and it is really beautifully shot and engaging. I would recommend it. It starts on Hulu on April 26th, streaming. Then we're going to go to a conversation with Stephanie Shriok, who is the president of Emily's List. Emily's List, of course, is focused on getting women to run for office, has been for its entire existence, but that work has taken on a different feeling now from what Shriok was talking about. And we talked about what Clinton's loss meant to that kind of women's political activism, and this question of whether it actually has led to more women getting involved politically from the first potential female president losing than what it would have been had Clinton won. And we also talked about what the actual resistance is in The Handmaid's Tale. The people who are fighting back against the society restrictive of women there call themselves the resistance. That book was written a long time ago, but still the same word. And Shriok talked about how the resistance and what her opposition to Trump is coming together in a different way than she had been expecting when she was at the Javits Center on election night, assuming that she'd be celebrating Hillary Clinton's win. But we're going to start off with another one of our featured reporters. This time it's with Annie Carney, who's one of my colleagues, covered the Clinton campaign alongside each other. Now she's covering the Trump White House. And one of the things that she specializes in is coverage of Ivanka Trump and this strange role that Ivanka Trump has taken on in the White House. And she'll actually be in Berlin with Ivanka Trump when she's there for this women's event with Angela Merkel at the chancellor's invitation. We're trying a bunch of new things, as you can tell. So I want to know your feedback. Let me know what you think. Email me at Isaac, I-S-A-A-C, at politico.com. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Facebook. But most importantly, subscribe and rate us on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. Now let's go to Annie Carney. What the people who are on the podcast today talk about, they're all women and they're all people who do not like Donald Trump and feel like he is anti-woman. What would Trump say to that? What would the Trump White House say to that charge?
They would clearly deny that charge.
Surprisingly.
They would probably point to like roundtables they've done with CEOs on women's empowerment issues and the group that Ivanka Trump set mm-hmm. up to greet Chancellor Merkel. You know, Ivanka Trump is the most senior advisor in the White House, and she's pitching her whole being on working on issues around women and girls.
And seems very sensitive to the attacks that women have made on her. That interview that
right.
Where she was asked about the complicit thing.
Yes, that was, she thinks it's sexist. She thinks the criticism is unfair. She thinks, like, no matter what she did, she would be made fun of. She thinks, like, if she just stayed in New York and ran her business and right. didn't do anything, people would say, why aren't you doing anything? And now she's trying to do something. It's like, why aren't you doing
that? But is it just Ivanka Trump? Is that the women's portfolio is with Ivanka Trump? Or is there other work that's being done to address that? I mean, there is a big concern among a lot of women that if only because of Trump's own personal behavior. Yeah. And, of course, the Access Hollywood tape and all that stuff.
Yeah. It's funny how much that's gone away.
Yeah.
Like, the campaign was all about, you know, more than a dozen women coming out and accusing him of assault or harassment. And like, we just don't hear about that anymore. Yeah. Those stories just went away. Like, where are those women?
But
we should look into that.
Now it's got a story to work on.
TBD on, like, Ivanka's going to have to come at some point it's going to be like, where's the beef?
Yeah.
For all the talk and all the panels, like you can do a lot of round tables and they're great photo ops. But what has she achieved? Oh, one thing that the Trump White House has struggled with, if you look at the photo ops, they've been really bad. Like Trump, so many pictures of Trump surrounded by all men at a table.
Which is funny. That was a problem for Obama, too. Yeah. But they took a lot of flack for it. But it wasn't the same thing of like Obama being anti-woman, although he did tend to surround himself with white men also.
I mean, they passed an executive order last week that gives states the right to not fund Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers. Ivanka Trump has not spoken out on the Planned Parenthood issue. She claims she's, you know, she gave the proceeds of her book she's going to give to charities that work with women and girls. It's still a lot of lip service with not a lot of points on the board where she can point to like what she's actually done for women.
So you're going to be in Berlin with her.
Mm-hmm.
What is this trip and how does it fit into what it is that she's doing and this weird role that she has within the White House?
Yeah, it's actually, I think, really interesting. Merkel invited her after her visit here where she had a very tense exchange with Trump, who like didn't shake her hand in the Oval. And it's
despite her asking,
right?
Like, this is time to shake hands.
She reached out to Ivanka to come to speak at this women's conference she's putting together, which... It's not the Trudeau did the same thing, looking at Ivanka as a way to like work the family angle to have diplomatic relations with this strange administration. He invited Ivanka Trump to go see a Broadway play. I think that the play was about accepting foreigners and tolerant. So it's kind of a genius move on his part. But I think world leaders, I've been told by White House officials that these are not the only two requests they've had from world leaders to do something with Ivanka, that she's really sought after. To work this family angle, to have she's like a diplomat.
No, and like her husband, who everybody wonders, well, why does everybody go to him? Well, part of it is that people are being smart. They see where the power is.
They see where the power is, right? And then with so much turmoil in the White House, like maybe Steve Bannon's out soon, maybe not.
Right.
But like the people are not going to be out.
Right. Ivanka Trump won't be out.
Yeah. So it's probably a good bet to like establish a relationship with her.
So you also had an interaction with another first daughter in the last couple of days. There was a cover of Variety, right, with Chelsea Clinton on it, which you pointed out that she, you said.
So the women's issues are so difficult sometimes. So she's on this cover of Variety magazine, a power woman issue, like huge smile on her face, wearing this leather jacket, just like it looked like a new rebranding of Chelsea. And she's laughing. And I just looked
like really laughing.
And I looked at this cover and I like just was staring at it thinking like, what is the reader supposed to be taking away from this? Like, why is she so happy? Like,
which is what you
what
tweeted.
And
so
I tweeted,
very
why is
good,
she so happy?
Snarky tweet, which I approve of.
And I got I was immediately like kind of went viral with people saying, why do you hate women? Why can't you allow women to be happy? Yeah. Stop picking on Chelsea. And then she responded with a very snarky response.
Yeah, she responded by saying that she was thinking about what her daughter Charlotte, like moments that filled her with joy.
Yeah.
And that she hoped that you had someone that brought joy to your life, something like that, right? So it's very, first of all, there's just no way that she was thinking about it. Like, that's not how
she wrote, like, I was thinking about all the amazing moments when Charlotte makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Hope the people in your life bring you so much joy or something like that. I just read it as I was surprised at, that she responded at all and took the bait. I mean, she's clearly, they're setting her up to run for something. Like, why, like, my question why is she so happy was more, why is she on a cover of a magazine right now?
Right.
What is going on with Chelsea Clinton, this relaunch? And her responding to that question made me think she might be a little thin-skinned for politics.
Yeah. That was Annie Carney. We're going to go to our conversation with Margaret Atwood and Elizabeth Moss. But first, let's hear from one of our other great Politico podcasts, which is pretty apropos for this episode. It's called Women Rule, and it's hosted by my friend and editor, Carrie Budoff-Brown.
When I was involved in a lot of these boards, I was the only woman in the room.
None of us got here by being namby-pamby.
All right, so there's a G-rated version and there's a not-so-G-rated version. Since this is a podcast, I guess I can do like the full-on version.
I've said to not just to Kellyanne, but to all women who are thinking about getting into this arena, you've got to try.
I'm Carrie Budoff-Brown, host of Politico's Women Rule podcast, and those were just a few of my favorite moments so far. Join me as we go backstage with bosses like Tina Chen, Valerie Jarrett, and Senator Deb Fischer. I want to know how these women made it to the top and what difference it makes when women are in power. Subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. New episodes every other Wednesday. Just search Women Rule.
And now my conversation with Margaret Atwood and Elizabeth Moss. We set the scene for you a little bit. We met at the Hay Adams Hotel in Washington, which is just about a block and a half from the White House. You can see the White House from the rooms or from the driveway. We met in this room. There was a press junket day for them. And the room that we were set up in had these really crazy murals all over the walls. It was like scenes from some sort of colonial, sort of pastoral, not quite clear what time period or geographical location it was supposed to be. It was pretty confusing. There were some, it looked like they could almost fit in with the characters in The Handmaid's Tale, but sort of not. And you will hear them trying to make sense of what was on the walls around them before we got into trying to make sense of what is going on in politics and what is going on in the book and the show.
Sort of some sort of dystopian world that hasn't been written yet.
Colonial fever dream.
Oh, if you need to start taking notes.
Actually, I wonder if it's intentionally different because it's different architecture as well.
It is.
You know
I think
I mean?
It is intentionally
I think it's
different.
Intentional. It's supposed to be different places.
Dream on, Elizabeth. People did this on purpose. Well, what I like is the shepherdess, whose top is falling off. She's right behind you.
Scandalous.
Quite scandalous. Yeah. I mean, if I were herding sheep, I wouldn't wear that, but
no.
Nor those white stockings.
Let's start by just getting this out of the way. What are your thoughts on Donald Trump and what his presidency represents, what his election represents, what he is?
All right. So the answer to what his presidency represents is we do not know, because it's different every day. And sometimes it's different even from what he said the day before. So the China is
sometimes
not...
Sometimes
within one day. It just depends. China's not a currency manipulator today. Who knew? But they might be a currency manipulator
they
tomorrow.
They were.
Well, maybe they weren't. Maybe they never were. Maybe that was a mistake. So we don't actually know, and nor do we know what the core ideological convictions or beliefs are, if any. We don't even know that. So that is for what this presidency represents. Answer, I do not know. Why did he get elected? That's a whole other question. I think he got elected because a lot of people were quite angry about their position in life, and nobody was paying attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were angry because they have seen the position of the middle class and the position that their children might be expected to have in the future. They have seen those diminish rather than increase. And people really need to address the huge imbalance in money, which has become more and more divergent ever since the 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. when things were a lot more equal, and now they're very unequal. And that is a problem. See the French Revolution.
And what about to each of you personally, when you think about that Donald Trump is the president, we're sitting a few blocks from the White House. He's there today, President Donald Trump. What does that say to you about the country, about your feelings about the country?
It's interesting because when I coming to D.C., because I have a nice view of the White House from this hotel, and I was actually looking at it last night, and it looked beautiful, and the flag on top and the monument behind it, and I was struck by how beautiful it looked. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of what my concept of this country is. And
which is what?
Well, what's in the Constitution and what it's built on, the ideas of freedom and equal rights. And so for me, I was actually quite moved to see this representation in this building of something that I actually, that is important to me. I actually have respect mm-hmm. for the institution. I have respect for democracy and I have respect for the Constitution. And I was sort of reminded of that, you know, and
seeing
it. Feels like
there's a butt there floating when it comes to
No, there's a so. There's okay. a so. So when I see things that go against that, when I see things that are infringements upon that, mm-hmm. and what I actually hold quite dear, then I find it infuriating and I think and frustrating. And to speak to what Margaret said as well, it's also, I feel like we're in a situation of trying to grab at the truth and trying to grab at the facts and trying to understand what's happening as well as best we can. Mm-hmm. And it's a constant struggle to do that as well. And I think that that is something that is equally as frustrating. You know, you can disagree with something if you have the facts.
As long as you know what it is.
As long as you know what it is.
That you're disagreeing with.
Exactly. But if you don't know, or if it's something that just keeps changing, then you're really in a very confused place.
And one of the most striking things to me about the book and the series is the assumption that's baked into both of them that this can all change so quickly, right? The whole, you have a whole society that you create with all these things and all these customs. And it's like at most maybe 10 years have elapsed since, no, you're shaking your head at me. It's more than that.
Yeah, my head shaking is a sort of an Indian agreement. Okay.
Right, because the Offred character was old enough to have been living a professional life and had a daughter, but is still young enough so that she's fertile, right? Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing.
Yeah, so that I would say within just a few years.
Yeah, even not less. Even
like,
10.
Yeah, like no, this. I mean, it seemed like at
yeah,
most 10.
When these things pivot, when these things pivot, they can do it very quickly, like really quickly. And, of course, being the age I am, you know who I'm remembering. Mm-hmm. So I'm remembering the whole trajectory of the rise of the Nazi Party mm-hmm. to power, and then how quickly, once that power was achieved, how quickly everything changed.
Yeah.
And you saw that in a somewhat slower form with the Russian Revolution. It took longer because there was a civil war. And Maoist China, again, it took longer because there was a civil war. But once the power is achieved, things can be pretty rapid. We just saw Mr. Erdogan... Mm-hmm. Voting himself or arranging to have voted for himself, however you feel about that election.
I think most people feel
sweeping new powers. We thought he had a lot of sweeping old powers. Mm-hmm. So how much more sweeping new powers?
But that's
does he need?
Changing the powers that he has. You're talking about a complete change in the society, right?
Not a complete change in the society, just to the rise to prominence and power of an element that was already in the society. Mm-hmm. Because you cannot change a society completely from without. There has to be something there that mm-hmm. you build that regime on. And they calculate that you need approximately 30% of people who agree with you in order to do that.
So when it's pretty clear where both of you are on Donald Trump. And how much do you worry, not maybe that we're going to be at Gilead, but that there could be these major changes that would be more than just like the politics that you don't agree with
right.
is winning out. There's something much deeper than that, that could change. I mean, maybe there's a stop short of totalitarian Gilead handmaids.
Right.
I mean, how
does something along the way station? Well,
Or do you think that like we could be within a couple of years?
I don't know, because give America credit, it's very ornery mm-hmm. as a country. It's very diverse, and you have already seen that people are not just going to stay at home for all of these things. So I think the danger would be that people get burnt out mm-hmm. and tired of watching the whirligig and trying to figure out what's going on, and they give up on it. And that would, of course, be a mistake. The very least they can do is vote in their local elections.
Mm-hmm. You wrote the book 30-plus years ago. Does it feel like it could happen more quickly now?
Or yes.
Yeah? Why?
Yeah, because more of the people interested in having those kinds of things happen are in power now. So the moment when you know that things have gone over the edge is the moment when the regime fires into the protest crowd.
Mm-hmm.
That's the moment.
Which you say, and
that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and it happens early out in the series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can't remember whether it's the second or third episode. It's the third episode. Okay. Right. One of the changes that it seemed to me that happened between the book and the series is that Offred becomes her previous life seems to be a little bit more urbane than she was. And maybe I'm misreading the book, but she seems like
her present life is more now.
Yeah. Is that all it is? Is it just sort of updated? I mean, in the book, she's transferring books onto disc, and now she's a book publisher,
yeah.
Right? Like, and
she's a librarian. Is she
book publishing?
It's a publishing.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah.
I mean, does that change the story? Does that change the way that you think of her?
She has a job. She has a job in a smartness area. So so she's literate. She's smart. She has a best college friend. We know that they've been to college, so she has some perspective from which to view all of this. And I think a number of things just got dated up to now, mm-hmm. as they would, because the series takes off from the now moment, which is now 2017, whereas the now moment before was 1984
or 5. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's very little, actually, it seems. And there are things in the book. They have, like, the CompuCard, which is now just a debit card.
Yeah.
But other than those sorts of things,
there were no cell phones once upon a time, long, long ago, and not that long ago.
It sounds like the stuff
of
fiction.
Yes. And then terrible on the way to cell phones, there were these things that were the size of shoeboxes you had in your car. And then there were the things you see in old James Bond films, which were very perky for the time, but they're quite large with a big antenna sticking up out of them. So all of those were way stations on the way to.
You know, there's the famous story of LBJ that he wanted a car phone. I think this is the way that went. And then the opposition leader got also a car phone, so LBJ got two car phones.
Well, they were huge. They were very large. They came in a little carrying bag.
Right. But this is even before. This is when even he was a before, Senate leader, in the early 60s.
Wow. That's amazing.
That must have been very high tech and rare at that time.
Yeah, for sure. What it means, great use of government money.
Yeah. What it means is that because we have all of these devices now, that it's possible to build an even greater data bank on each individual than was possible with just a credit card.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Credit cards came in the 70s originally.
Yeah.
And I remember them in Europe. It was like playing Russian roulette. I mean, you stuck your card into a machine and it said, you are a criminal. Take your card out immediately, and you would take it out, you'd stick it in again, and it would give you $100. So it was like gambling. You just never
just
knew.
Took your chances?
Yeah.
Margaret said quite earlier, when she was talking about that, she said quite terrifyingly that because of the database now, how difficult it would be to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
It would be difficult. Unless you had never laid a data trail at all.
Ever.
Yeah.
Which is
so we have some sci-fi, I forget exactly which one, but I think it's by William Gibson, in which there are individuals who are below the radar, and of course they hold very privileged positions because nobody knows that they exist.
Yeah.
The authorities don't know they exist.
Yeah.
So if you never registered your child, if you never sent them to school, if you never got any documents for them, if you never got them a device.
But then there's a story that I heard, I think it was maybe on This American Life, of a girl who was brought up that way and then was trying to so she was brought up homeschooled, everything, mm-hmm. and then tried to establish that she was an actual citizen.
A person, and she couldn't.
And it was really difficult and couldn't do it.
Because there was no record.
Right, and so, because the society demanded.
And then what
like
happened?
Non-entity.
She could sell her services on the digital block market.
Yeah, she's going to be very valuable one day.
So, can you just tell me, do you remember the election day shooting that day?
I do.
What were you shooting then?
We actually were shooting two scenes that would have been so interesting and relevant before and then sort of became 1,000 times more interesting and relevant. You know, I was up really late watching the election, mm-hmm. and I had to get up. I had only had a few hours sleep and got up, and I had two scenes with Joe Fiennes, who plays the commander, and mm-hmm. one of them was where I guess it was episodes 4 and 5, and one of them is when he explains to me what nolita debestardis carbon dorum means, mm-hmm. which is the Latin phrase meaning loosely meaning don't let the bastards grind you down, and of course you couldn't help but take a little bit of an extra inhale of breath that scene.
Did it change the acting choices that you make from that point forward?
I don't know if it changes them. Maybe it deepens them or makes them more personal, you know? Mm-hmm. Hopefully I would have done the same thing anyways, but I think that it can't help but make them feel a little bit more personal, you know? And then the next one was the scene where he tells me something awful he's done to a woman, a friend of mine, and then says things are never better for everyone. They're always worse for some.
Right.
Is that right? Things aren't always better for everyone.
Yeah.
They're always worse for some. And
I think it's never better.
Never better. Is it okay? Yeah. Good. And it's a credible
it's
line
to quote an author's work.
I had her do it. I had her do it earlier to make sure we got it right. It was incredibly chilling when I read it in the book. It was mm-hmm. chilling in the script to hear him say it on that particular day. I literally had full body chills mm-hmm. because you couldn't help but feel that there was just something in the air.
Well, it follows a line of his in which he says, "We wanted to make the world better."
Yeah, mm-hmm. and she says, "Better for whom?"
Right.
Better.
So, do you think people who voted for Donald Trump, who support Donald Trump, should watch this? Would they?
Yeah. For sure. Absolutely.
Will they get the same thing out of it, you think?
Yeah.
No.
I mean,
hey, good idea. Yeah. No, I don't think all of them will, because I think a lot of them voted for their jobs. They voted for the fact that things are not economically good for mm-hmm. them or for their children. It's more likely to be for their children. And a way of life and a job base that used to exist has disappeared. And he promised to bring that back. Now, will he be able to keep that promise? Let's find out. But it's unlikely, for instance, in the coal industry, which even if the market for coal did improve, is automated. You know, a lot of those jobs that used to be people jobs are now machine jobs, and that's what's happened to a lot of industry. And people are going to have to think about that too, because if you have something in which everything is made by robots, except possibly makeup artists, you don't want them malfunctioning while they're doing your eyeliner. No, really.
That's less of a problem for me.
Who is going to buy all of these things that are being made, and what are they going to buy them with?
Right.
And Henry Ford, whatever you may think of him, had that one figured out, which is why he didn't automate his car factories. Who's going to buy my cars, he said, if I do that?
But I guess the question is that, you know, you could see the series, the novel, as being part of what some people say, like, oh, it's the left intelligentsia looking down on, and saying, like, this is what, you know, you're becoming, and that kind of response.
I just took people at their word. You know, I was reading newspapers in the 1984, and that's what people were saying they wanted to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't call that looking down. I call it, you know, literally accepting what they have said and saying this is what it would be like.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you about something. You tweet a lot, which I think most people would not expect of...
Yeah, it was an accident.
you're a novelist. You're not a millennial.
I'm not.
What kind of insight do you think that gives you into to Trump and the, you know, he is the Twitter president?
Yeah, I don't think it gives me any insight. Nothing.
I'm sorry. You think he should stop tweeting?
No. He can do as he wishes. I think it's another sideshow. You don't know how much of the vacillation and pivoting and contradiction is actually just what magicians do, mm-hmm. which is watch my hand over here, and meanwhile with my other hand I'm doing the real thing mm-hmm. that you're not looking at because I've distracted you.
Do you think that that's what he's doing?
I don't know.
Right? There are these different thoughts on Trump, whether it's a distraction, it's all on purpose, it's all random. It's
yeah,
all,
I know.
You know, unpredictability is a strategy, or he's just unpredictable.
Well, it is like
or he really is just unpredictable.
It's like a movie screen on which there is an ambiguous image mm-hmm. and then you ask the audience to interpret it mm-hmm. and you're going to get all kinds of different interpretations because the image is inherently ambiguous. Mm. So is it a lion? Is it somebody with a lot of hair? Is it a mm-hmm. what is it? Is it a jellyfish? What are we looking at? And we don't know, and if we really knew, there wouldn't be all of this discussion.
So is it more surreal walking around Washington with this being the reality that we're in or walking onto the set?
Or the illusion of reality that we're in. You don't know.
Well, but you had this strange experience, right? You wrote a book 32 years ago, and then now it came to life around you. You got to, and there's a scene where you slap Elizabeth. So you got to actually be part of it. Was that surreal in a different way, or is it just it's all just this weird world we're living in at this moment, or nothing is completely?
Always found the world rather weird. In fact, the world always has been quite weird. It's just that we took for granted in certain parts of this country that there was a normality, and that was normality, mm-hmm. and that. Rights were inalienable. I don't know where anybody ever got that idea because they didn't come down out of a cloud. Mm-hmm. They were thought up and fought for by people. That's mm-hmm. where rights come from. Mm-hmm. And that's how they get taken away. People take them away. So what is normal and how much can we count on it? And our idea of what is normal changes a lot depending on the circumstances. Okay. So when Aunt Lydia says, this may not seem normal to you now, mm-hmm. it's very scary. What is going to be mm-hmm. the new normal?
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask you to chime in on that before we close? The sense of you were living in that alternate world in a set and all of the scenes that you were doing and then how does that compare to the experience of like what you were saying, looking out at the White House last night and seeing this difference in your mind between the ideal of America that you have and, mm-hmm. and thinking about your reaction to what's going on now?
Yeah, you know, like I said, it is the most surreal experience, and I think in a way, like I said too, like everything in that book and everything in the show is already important to me and already mm-hmm. was important to me and was important to me last year and was important to me when I read it when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. But you cannot help but personalize it so much more. You can't help but come to a place like D.C. and look at the White House and think about the last time you thought about the White House or D.C., which is when we were talking about, you know, what happens to D.C. in the book, which is not great. You know, so you can't help but... You can't help but draw those parallels in your mind, especially if you've been living the show for the past year. Honestly, I signed in April a year ago, and we're still involved in post. We're still working on mm-hmm. episode 10, the final episode. So I've lived the show for a year. So everything to me is Handmaid's Tale. Like, and so, of course, coming to D.C., and which is sort of the political center of the country, you're supposed to be, you know, it's like it can't help but feel more resonant and more personal. All of it, you know, which I don't think is a bad thing, because shouldn't we be personalizing politics?
I mean, I work for Politico. So,
so you have. You're clearly taking it personally.
It pays the bill.
Yeah.
All right. Margaret Atwood, Elizabeth Moss, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
So before the election, you and I talked, I remember it was the morning after the third debate in Las Vegas, because I was still in my hotel room in Las Vegas. And I was working on an article that I think ended up beginning, like, the irony is that Donald Trump's candidacy might end up being the best thing for women, because there was the sense that he was going to lose and that he was going to help drive up female turnout to help female candidates, a lot of strong female candidates that were out there. A number of the people that I talked to for that article actually won their races, like Catherine Cortez Masto. And it was not a bad year for women. But it was not what you were expecting.
Not the year we wanted, that's for sure.
So when you think back on sort of where the mindset was then about what it would have meant for women, obviously, had we elected as a country our first female president, you wanted Hillary Clinton to win also because of politics.
Yeah, that is very true.
Does that just seem like a weird fantasy world now, so distant?
Well, this is such a good reminder that elections have ramifications, and the ramifications is something that we're all living with every single day under this current administration. But I think back to our conversation that morning, because I also that day spent some time not only with Catherine Cortez Masto, who became the first Latina mm-hmm. to ever serve in the Senate, but I went over to Henderson, where we had one of the first ever all-female ballots from the presidency, Senate, U.S. House, State Senate, and State House. And all those women won. Mm-hmm. Like, all those women are serving in Nevada. And so it's a nice memory to think about that one Nevada moment. And women, our women at Emily's List, fared okay. I mean, four new women senators, eight new women in the House of Representatives. But I had a lot of conversations that maybe I hadn't quite gotten to this thinking when you and I spoke after that third debate, but in the days getting closer to the election. And I described it like this. You folks kept asking me, are women really excited about this? We're not really seeing this. And I kept explaining that everywhere I went, and every time I talked to, whether it was our members mm-hmm. or activists and volunteers, there was a pent-up emotion in so many women of all ages about what this was going to mean, mm-hmm. about seeing Hillary Clinton.
In a way that just wasn't coming out.
And it was like, I'm too afraid to show it. It might not happen. I'm going to contain it. I'm going to just keep going until it happens. I don't want anybody to think that I care too much about this. But it was pent up.
Why do you think that was? Is it because they didn't want to believe, like, they couldn't convince themselves it could happen?
I was going to say, I think it's a combination of, we always get so close and it's taken away, and there's a lot of women who have a lot of stories about that in their lives, whether it's work-related or personal-related. That mm-hmm. does happen. The fear to believe and then be hurt at the end, I think that was part of it. And I think part of it is just sometimes culturally, there's pressure on women to, like, why would you vote for a woman just because she's a woman? You're not thinking this through.
Yeah.
And that's a really unfair thing to do. Women don't vote for women because they're women. And I assume men don't vote for men just because they're men. I don't know that for sure, but maybe maybe some, and maybe some women too. But on the majority, I think we're looking for the best candidates, right? We're looking for the best candidates as voters. And so saying I'm excited about voting for Hillary, and I am excited about breaking this glass ceiling, I think there was a real hesitancy in that. And I think it's just a little bit cultural, and folks were getting sort of beat up online about this. So I say there was all this pent-up energy, and I told folks on election night, it is going to explode, and there are going to be, I mean, tears of joy is how I described it, tears of joy flooding. Not just, you know, the Javis Center, New York, but
living rooms across our country, because so many women had this emotion inside and were too afraid to believe. So we did it. That's not what happened.
So what does it mean for women's activism, political activism, that that you came close, pretty close, and won the popular vote?
Popular vote by nearly 3 million votes.
But didn't win.
But she's not the president. That's right. She's not the president. Well, that pent-up emotion, it still exploded. And that was something I didn't even expect on election night. It resulted immediately into action. Mm-hmm. And it was, we must resist, we must lead the resistance, we must find ways to get organized and stop what we believe Donald Trump is going to do and has begun doing, which is to roll back the clock on women's rights and opportunities, and our families' opportunities. Yeah. And that happened instantly.
Do you think it happened more in the response to that she lost than it would have happened had she won? Because you do see this sprouting up. You guys have had a lot of energy. There's like the She Should Run, the lot of women turning out to try to get recruited by the DCCC and for governor and for all sorts of things. It seems like there was this explosion that could not maybe have been there in the same way had Hillary Clinton been the president.
I think about that question a lot. Like, was it that Hillary Clinton lost or was it that Donald Trump won? And I think for different women, it was one or the other. I think it switches. I think for various mm-hmm. people, it's one or the other. I met with four women who have signed up at Emily's List to our Run to Win program, mm-hmm. which is we're calling on women across the country to either, you know, run for office or help a sister run for office. And I was talking to four of these folks in Lansing, and I asked all four of them, so why now? Like, what was it now?
Yeah.
None of them mentioned the words Donald Trump. They all talked about Hillary Clinton. They talked about... One talked about how inspired they were and how shocked they were that she lost and it was so unfair. Another one talked about how they were just so certain. It was so easy. It was so certain that they couldn't believe that this happened. And so I'd say that is, I think it's both. I think there's definitely a reaction to Donald Trump, but think there's also that.
Is there more women's political activism in the wake of Hillary losing than there would have been had she won?
Well,
I mean, in a weird
twist. I don't know the answer because I would have rather have tried it the other way.
Well, sure.
I think our country would definitely be on a better trajectory in the other direction. I don't know the answer. I know what's happening now, and what's happening now is unprecedented. I mean, Emily's List has been working to elect pro-choice Democratic women for over three decades, since the mid-1980s. What we have spent most of those years doing is recruiting and encouraging women to think about running, to just chew on it and don't say never, and we'll be there, we'll have your back, we'll help you set up the campaigns. You just got to do it. You got to do it. We're like the cheerleaders. We're like, you can do this. And we've had success in that, and we've elected hundreds and hundreds of women across the country with that. But that's usually how it goes. And yes, every cycle, more women come through these doors. And last election cycle, we were really excited because over 920 women came to Emily's List talking to us about running over the whole cycle. And honestly, I was like, that's pretty good for us. We've had 12,000 women since Election Day come to us and say, I want to run.
And of that 12,000, how many do you think will actually activate on it?
That is the million-dollar question, right? Here's the thing. Some will do it now, but some are going to do it in 5 years, and some are going to do it in 10 years. The fact that they have crossed over the barrier of wanting to run from not wanting to run is huge.
And that gives us an incredible pipeline of leaders to encourage for city council races, for legislative races. I know there's some House candidates in that group. There are future senators in that group. I bet there is a future presidential candidate in that group, because it is a shift that we've never seen. And the same groups of women across the country, and we're seeing at different ages, and you should run for something, and millennials jumping up and wanting to run. It is a call to take action and have our voices heard in our government. And we're seeing that across the board.
The day after the inauguration was the Women's March, or Women's Marches, I guess, yeah. I should say. I was at the one in D.C. yeah. And was reporting on it, surprised that there were as many people there as there were.
Yeah, you're telling me. I don't know how you felt. I felt like
it was hard to get out of the metro. That's what.
Oh, yeah. You got in? You got in the metro?
I got in the metro, but not... but to go and report on it, I was not expecting it to be as big as it was. Mm-hmm. And now, and you're going to give the award, the Emily's List Award this year, to the resistance. It seems like, you sort of, a lot of people position as like women versus Donald Trump. Is that the way to think about this?
Oh, I think there's a growing number of Americans who are opposing Donald Trump, but so much of this is being led by women. I think about the fabulous women leaders who organized the march in Washington, but also the marches all across the country in small towns and big cities. I think about the women who, as attorneys, went to the airports to try to ensure that people could get into this country when the initial travel ban came in, and then fought it back.
Right. But attorneys, right? They were not going as women. And I think that's the important thing happening here. Right?
I think that's where we get – it's seeing women step up in whatever capacity they are to make change. We happen to be women. But we love this country, and we want this country to be stronger, and we want this country to provide opportunities for everyone. And it is those women across the country that are taking action. I mean, you probably saw some of the polling recently that they were trying to figure out who was doing all of the calling into the United States Senate, and they found that 86% of the calls coming in mostly against the nominations of the Trump cabinet were from women. I mean, this is extraordinary.
Do you have any hope that you'll see something out of the Trump White House that will make you feel less, I don't know what the right way to characterize your feelings about it now, opposed, frightened, turned off by, disgusted? It seems like all of those are probably where you are on Trump.
I will say, I mean, as an American, I hope so, right? I mean,
but do you believe that there's a chance? Trump is, because of the kind of political character he is, right? People say like, well, maybe he'll change, maybe he'll be different. And so there is this like sense from some that what you're getting now might not be what you'll get in 6 months or in a year. Do you think that will be an issue, a change in any substantive way?
I mean, I don't believe it. Yeah. I don't believe it. I mean, this is someone who, during his entire campaign, told us what he was going to do. And we were like, oh, he would never go that far. And since he's been in office, that's exactly what he's tried to do. I mean, particularly as it relates to women's health care. They're going to try to put through another repeal of the Affordable Care Act and put in their own Trump care, Ryan care, whatever you want to call it. The last round was defunding Planned Parenthood and getting rid of maternity coverage. Now it sounds like they're going to let states possibly opt out of providing some basic preventive care. I mean, this is really rolling the clock backward on women, but it's also not just on the healthcare or the Muslim ban, that's so, so offensive, but even internationally, we see this all the time at Emily's List, particularly in our polling of women voters going into elections, where the country stands in the world and the security of the nation is really important to women, because they're also, are my children safe here? Yeah. And this uncertainty that he's that he's instilling around the world is terrifying.
Do you have any hope in the idea that Ivanka Trump is managing the sort of women's issues portfolio for the White House and that she'll take care of it, and which seems to be what she is trying to project and what the White House is projecting on her behalf?
Now that she is actually working in the White House, you know, for a while she was sort of outside doing this. But now that she's working in the White House, she's, as far as I'm concerned, she's part of an administration that is pushing a bad health care bill that's going to strip insurance away from 24 million. It's going to defund Planned Parenthood. I mean, he signed an executive order that was going to roll back some of the equal pay regulations that were helping. She was in his ear then.
So when, Ivanka Trump says that she's championing women's issues, what do you say to her?
Say, when are we going to see that?
She's off to meet with Angela Merkel and do a women's conference there. It's all taken care of in their minds on this.
That alone, like after the meeting with Donald Trump and Merkel here in the United States, and that very strange incident of the handshake, right? Yeah. The missed handshake. And he's going to, like, Merkel's in charge of Germany. How do I put this? Because I find it so offensive. Does he not think of Merkel as an equal, Donald Trump?
Well, Merkel invited Ivanka Trump. I mean, part of what's going on here is that
people are trying to figure out a way into the administration, right?
We're looking at Jared Kushner and saying, like, these are the people who have the power, so you know, why not work them, right?
Well, these folks, Ivanka and Kushner, have had his ear since the beginning of this campaign. Like, they're part of the family. And what we have gotten is some pretty, dare I say, policies that have been very devastating, suggestions of policies that are even more devastating to women. On top of that, it's the photo coming out of the White House of all men in a room signing a bill on women's health care. Right? It is a constant churn of sort of pushing, it feels like pushing women aside. And that's got to start at the top. And Donald Trump seems to have no interest in that whatsoever.
I told you that I talked to Margaret Atwood and Elizabeth Moss. And I'm curious what your thought is on both the role of art in thinking this stuff through. Of course, in The Handmaid's Tale, it refers to the resistance. That's what they're called. That book was written and published in 1985, so she must have come up with that sometime in like 83 or 84. When I talked to them, Moss was wearing a Je Suis une Suffragette t-shirt, so she's...
That's fantastic.
I think her politics and yours probably agree on at least the issue of the presidency. So I'm curious both in terms of how you see art playing into this and how you see the activism from celebrities playing into what this is going to be over the months and years ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think of it exactly as you just asked before, which was the women who are attorneys who went to the airport, you know, they went as attorneys, but they're still women. I think it's fantastic that whoever you are and whatever your background is, that you can bring your experience to this movement. And it's so incredibly important for all of us to think about what we bring to the resistance. And in this case, I think it's just fantastic to see more of our artists, our musicians, our actresses step up, because they have such an incredible voice and they really have an opportunity to educate a lot of folks and to move people through. I mean, we know how powerful it is to move people through art. I think it's very, very important. But it's just, for me, a continuation of the 12,000 women who want to run and the building of armies of attorneys to go fight for people. And I think this is another piece. And by the way, the resistance is working. I mean, this is a Republican Congress and a president who has passed no significant legislation. They failed thus far, anyway, on their attempt on repealing the Affordable Care Act. The travel ban is stuck in the courts. Like, they have not been successful. And a lot of this is the resistance, putting pressure in town halls, on phone calls, in the press, in the public. It's working. We got to keep going, and
but
we got to go with all we
question,
got.
But that's the big question, right, when it comes to the resistance, is how you keep the enthusiasm up, right? Because that is hard always in politics. It's proven very difficult for Democrats in general. In fact, the article that I wrote, I'm remembering it off of the Women's March, that I think the first sentence is, they want it to be the Tea Party, but they're worried it'll be Occupy Wall Street, right? Like, this idea that the resistance will actually get elected. You know, the Tea Party won. They changed the way the government works. Occupy Wall Street sat in some parks for a while, and then nothing really changed, right?
Right, but that's already proven
right.
to be so far, right?
So does that make you feel confident going into the end of this year? I get this question all the time.
I have total confidence in this energy continuing to grow. And it's organizing now, and it's organizing through organizations like Emily's List, but it's also organizing through the huddles around the women's movement community. It's organizing through Indivisible. I mean, I could just keep going on and on. It is, and it's taking action at the local level. I mean, we just had a special election primary in Georgia, a seat that was Newt Gingrich's seat, a seat that Mitt Romney won by over 20 points. It was close with Trump versus Hillary. She lost by one. And our Democratic candidate raised over $8 million, had so many boots on the ground, and got what, 48% of the vote in an 11-way primary. It's happening. Like, the electoral piece of it is already happening, and it's happening with the women who are stepping up, wanting to run for House seats across the country. It's unprecedented.
So, last question here. You're a big Hillary Clinton fan. You not only wanted her to win and voted for her, I assume, even though it's a secret ballot, but
I probably voted for her.
it's more than just you wanted the Democratic candidate to win. You're very attached to, and more than, like, she's a woman. As Barack Obama has been trying to figure out his post-presidency, one of the things that is very much on his mind was, from the outset of trying to figure out life under Trump, was that he wanted to pull back and not be a big public presence, and certainly not be a direct opposition to Trump, even as he starts to edge forward in these next couple of weeks. Hillary Clinton has been out and about a bunch lately. What role do you see her playing? Is there the danger of her continuing to be someone who, like, Obama's worry is that the Democrats won't get to the next generation if he's crowding out the sun. Is that an issue with Hillary Clinton, or is it that should she step back? Should she be more active than she has been, or is she, you think she's just got it just right?
And I think about that with President Obama as well. I actually don't buy that they will take up all of the spotlight. I think they've got very important voices in this moment, and they're going to have to figure out exactly the right place to use their voices. And Hillary, as we've seen, is doing some of that, and I am sure President Obama will do that and do that appropriately. These are very, very,
like,
smart people.
She's been more directly against Trump and political than I think we're going to see out of him, at least for
right,
a while.
Yeah, well, we are talking.
Of course, he was the president.
I was just going to say, there's sort of the, I don't know if there are, well, there are no more rules, it seems like, around the presidency, but sort of the old unwritten rules of sort of getting out of the way of the next president and the good, clean transfer of power puts President Obama in a very different place. But Hillary Clinton has served this nation in so many capacities, including for incredible years as Secretary of State. And let me remind everybody, like, her favorability leaving the Secretary of State post was if not close to 70.
I mean, it's the constant pattern of her life is that people like her when she's not running for something.
She's really good while she's serving the nation. And I think she's going to find her voice as a stateswoman of this country. And that's going to be very, very important. But the generations that are coming up right now are so powerful and so exciting. And, you know, a lot of folks ask me, well, I hear this all the time. There's no bench. Are you kidding me? We have a great bench. I mean, Emily's list has a great bench. I mean, think about women who should be pondering running for president. I hope it's in their head. Are folks like Senator Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand and Amy Klobuchar, Senator Kamala Harris, fantastic new senator from California. And now we're recruiting for women to run for governorship in 18. And boy, there are some really good quality candidates coming up. You know, that's your next round, right? I mean, the bench is building. It's there. There's also a lot of good men. I'm talking about the women. I agree that there's actually some good men.
Emily's list is focused on women.
There are some good men in that pool. I just want to say that. I realize that. I think in a moment like this, this is not a normal presidency. And I think a lot of folks in this country know that. You don't have a president with a favorable 40 or under without some grave concerns about the direction of his administration. And in a situation like this, with the uncertainty that he's placing internationally, and I would argue rapidly economically in this country, I think we need all the voices we can get.
All right, Stephanie Shriok, thanks for taking the time.
Great, thank you so much.
That's it. Okay, if you've gotten this far, you like the podcast, and that is great news. But here would be even better news if you told a friend about it, if you got on iTunes and made sure to rate and review, and also, of course, to subscribe so that you'll get the next episode right into your podcast app, whatever app it may be.